Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 157 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week could, to my mind, be a rock and roll Hall of Famer just for his songwriting in the 60s. But then, in the 70s, he was a key member, songwriter, and singer in one of the decade's most innovative bands, Graham Gouldman of 10cc. I'm not in love, so don't forget it. It's just a silly phase I'm going through. With Eric Stewart, Gouldman co-wrote 10cc's biggest hits, The Utterly Hypnotic, I'm Not in Love, The Ebullient Earworm, The Things We Do for Love, and The Island Misadventure, Dreadlock Holiday, on which Gouldman sings lead. But before 10cc existed, Gouldman already had written classic songs for other artists. For Your Love and Heart Full of Soul by the Yardbirds, Bus Stop and Look Through Any Window by the Hollies, No Milk Today and Listen People by Herman's Hermits, and more. Bus Stop, by the way, is one of my all-time favorite bridges, and I ask him about a trick of his songwriting that I picked up on. In the late 60s and early 70s, Gouldman was writing and producing bubblegum pop songs for hire. Sausalito Is the Place to Go, for example, was credited to the Ohio Express of Yummy 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 fame, but actually is Gouldman singing a song he wrote. Loaded round, round, came in on the floor. There I found Sausalito. And the backing band is him and his future 10cc mates, Lal Cream, Kevin Godley, and Eric Stewart. Gouldman knew Godley and Cream from elementary school in Manchester, and the three of them plus Stewart became the house band at Strawberry Studios, where Stewart was the chief engineer and Gouldman a partner. After playing on various bubblegum tracks and backing Neil Sedaka on his 1972 album Solitaire, the foursome started working on their own material, such as the doo-wop send-up Donna. That Godly Cream song became the first 10cc single, and it hit number 2 in the UK. That version of 10cc went on to record 4 albums together, each completely distinct. The self-titled 1973 debut continued in the jokey throwback vibe, with Gouldman a co-writer on Rubber Bullets, a sort of jailhouse rock gone haywire. Sheep Music from 1974 covered more ground and packed more punch, starting with the Stewart Gouldman banger, The Wall Street Shuffle. 1975's the original soundtrack includes I'm Not in Love, as well as the Godly Cream almost 9-minute suite Une Nuit à Paris, or One Night in Paris for those of us bad at pronouncing French. The relatively chilly How Dare You from 1976 featured the barbed, funky Stewart Gouldman song Art for Art's Sake, but by then the divide between the two songwriting teams had become pronounced. As the band was planning its 5th album, Godley and Cream expressed their distaste for a particular new Stewart Gouldman song. Gouldman here confirms which one it was, and they left to record a triple concept album that made use of the Gizmotron guitar device they'd invented. Stewart and Gouldman continued on as 10cc and recorded the 1977 album Deceptive Bends, which includes the smash The Things We Do for Love, as well as the rockin' Good Morning Judge. Bloody Tourists from the following year includes Dreadlock Holiday, a number one hit almost everywhere but the U.S. Subsequent 10cc albums did less well commercially and artistically. In the mid to late 80s, Gouldman made 4 albums with American singer-songwriter Andrew Gold in the band Wax. He also briefly collaborated with Godley in the early 2000s. Gouldman is the one still using the 10cc name, and the band toured the U.S. this summer for the first time since 1978. I caught them at the Arcata in St. Charles. Although Gouldman is the only original member, he's playing with the same drummer, Paul Burgess, and guitarist, Rick Fenn, who toured and played with 10cc in the 1970s. Gouldman's 10cc shows concentrate on those first 5 albums, including the Godley and Cream songs, and he makes a point of crediting the other writers. Gouldman also continues making his own music. Earlier this year, he released a new album, I Have Notes, with Queen guitarist Brian May playing on the lead track, Floating in Heaven. Gouldman had been on my wish list since I launched Caro Pop, and I loved hearing him talk about songwriting, collaborations, the fractured relationships with certain bandmates, and his carrying on as 10cc. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Graham Gouldman. Our future lies above the clouds. Well, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. I've been I've enjoyed your music for a long time, and
thank you very much.
You know, like all the 10cc, but a lot of it beforehand too. So, and I enjoyed seeing your show in St. Charles. So, first of all, I didn't realize it had been that long since you toured the U.S.
Yeah, 78, I think it was.
How was it that long that, you know, between 78 and now that you hadn't played the U.S.?
I guess it wasn't. We'd had offers, but it wasn't. Didn't make financial sense. You know, it's quite an expensive show, not as expensive as some, obviously, but even so, we'd had several offers from different agents and promoters, I mean, and it just didn't work out. But this one kind of did.
Well, and it was fascinating to me that you really had the old band together. I mean, except for the fact that, I mean, you didn't, you know, you were the one of the principals who was left, but Paul Burgess, who'd been playing with you since what, 73, and
that's
Rick
right.
Fenn, like it's all those people who, you know, played on Bloody Tourists.
Yeah, 76, so Rick joined. Yeah, so it gives it some extra weight, you know, with having only one original member. But you know, that one's got to be aware that they were a very important part of the band as well.
Well, the thing that surprised me was, you know, a lot of times people will tour later and they'll kind of highlight, well, these are the songs that I sang, you know, and then that other stuff doesn't happen. But you really presented like this is 10cc, and you fairly represented all that stuff, you know, the crap.
Yes, I think I did, and also we want to credit the songwriters who wrote it. Make sure nobody thinks, well, I didn't write this one, but I wrote this one, you know.
Right. No, you were very studious about it. You said, like, this is a Godly Krem song that I adore and this and
yeah.
that. And
exactly.
And so it really felt like, oh, this is, you know, because I was a little young to see 10cc when you came around in 78, or I didn't, you know, wasn't up on it. In terms of, so I feel like I got to see, you know, that show. And I thought that was really great. You know, opening with Second City into the Last
right.
Supper. I'm like, oh, that's a good one. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you joined 10cc, how many songs had you already written?
We'd written a few. When I joined 10cc, I didn't join 10cc. 10cc
right.
kind of evolved in Strawberry Studios. The four of us were kind of came together, and we were kind of like a house band for the studio. Then I think it was in 71, we recorded an album with Neil Sedaka.
Right, Solitaire.
Solitaire album. And I think it was after that we thought, because we've been started writing together and recording when the studio wasn't busy. And it suddenly occurred to us that, you know, we could be a band. I think we could do really well. And we'd recorded Donna, which was originally going to be a B-side to another track. And that became our, you know, we thought, oh, this is something about this. Sent it to Jonathan King, who was running UK Records at the time. And he said, it's great. I want to sign you. And so we were born.
Right. But by that time, you'd already had this incredible career as a songwriter. I mean, you wrote
yeah.
For Your Love and Heart Full of Soul and Bus Stop, which is one of my favorite songs of like the entire 60s.
Okay.
Bus Stop, I just have to say, I wrote a songwriting book with a friend who's a musician several years ago, and it's called Take It to the Bridge, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside You. And so we ended up talking a lot about bridges. And I think
all
Bus
right.
Stop has one of my favorite bridges of all time. It's just like fantastic bridge. So thank
yeah,
you for you writing know, such a great bridge.
Okay, thank you. I wrote that, the words and the music in my head. I normally write with a guitar, but that whole thing came to me just who knows from where. Amazing.
I was, you know, thinking of like trying to think about like, what, you know, are there sort of trademark things that you were doing in those songs back then? Like that and No Milk Today, there's kind of this sort of shifting between the major and the minor, which.
Yeah. I did that a lot. There were two things I did quite a lot of in retrospect. Shifting from the major, to say if I was something in A minor, I'd go to A major and then back again.
Yeah.
And the other thing I did was that the House of the Rising Sun chords, like A minor to C to D to F. Bam, bam, bam.
That's interesting. I had not picked up on that one.
Which is For Your Love, of course.
Right. And yeah, and for Your Love, you would, with the Mockingbirds, you'd propose that as a single to Columbia, and they're like, nah, that song's not commercial.
Nah. And that was, you know, that was a bit of good luck for me in a way. Well, an amazing piece of luck. Who knows what would have happened, but we don't know. But there you go.
So now you and Kevin and Lal knew each other growing up, right?
Yeah.
In Manchester.
We're in Manchester. We were in different bands that was used rooms at a club called the Jewish Lads Brigade, the JLB. And they would allow us to use rooms for rehearsals. And I think the deal was that they let us have the rooms for nothing, but we would play at like social events and things like that, if memory serves. I think that's what the deal was. So the JLB became a really important place, because not only for the bands we were rehearsing with, but where me and Kevin Lowell met each other. Although actually I was at the same primary school with Kevin, but he's slightly older than me, so he was in a different class.
And was Eric, you intersected with him a little later?
Yeah, well, Eric I met because my manager at the time had an office in Kennedy Street Enterprises, which were a music agency, and Eric's band, which was Wayne Fontana and the Mindbenders, were signed to that agency.
So did you have
And I met Eric there at that office.
Did you have any sense that, you know, all of you would end up doing music together, or was it just you all had the sort of shared interest?
I guess we had a shared interest. I mean, we were lucky in that the kind of the stars aligned for us, for the four of us. You know, the chemistry could have been different and maybe wouldn't have worked, but we had different influences and we had common influences. And bringing all those elements together created something very special, I think.
When you have childhood friends, you know, and you're an adult, those relationships are different than the ones where you, you know, became friends in your 30s or even your 20s. Like, yeah. How does the fact that you guys knew each other so young sort of affect what your relationships were like, you know, getting older?
Well, the only person I've got a relationship now with, which is a very close relationship, is Kevin. Kevin Godley and I have worked on many projects since he and Lal split the band. Lal I did see a few years ago, and it was very nice to see him. We had a nice chat. Eric, I haven't seen for decades. But the me and Kevin have, we've recorded together. Kevin's provided a lot of videos for our, when we do our full show, which we unfortunately couldn't do in on the American tour. But he provides this three videos that we use during the show that that he's done, which are great.
Right. Yeah, the two of you recorded,
that's an ongoing relationship.
Yeah, the two of you recorded songs together, 2006, I think it was. You put out like four songs.
Yeah, GGO6, the project was called.
Well, what I was thinking about with the sort of the childhood friends is like even when you're sort of making those, you know, 410cc albums together, it's like there's always kind of some baggage from like something you remember when you were like in, you know, 10 years old, and you sort of like the friends who I have who were like older than me when I was a kid, it still seemed like my older brother type person or younger brother type person. Whereas, you know, I'm friends with a lot of people who are older than younger, and I don't think that way. And I'm just sort of wondering whether any of that baggage sort of carried on when you actually were collaborating.
I don't think it did. I wasn't not aware of it anyway, not on a conscious level. But who knows? I can't prove it either way, whether it was or, you know, that happened or not. But I need to think about that a bit. I don't think I was aware of that.
When you started out, did you have sort of these dreams of like, I'm going to be, you know, in a rock band, I'm going to be a rock star? Were you drawn more to the writing part of it? Or because at some point you became sort of primarily a writer.
Yeah.
But you were also in these bands like, you know, the Mockingbirds and, you know, some others before that.
I always wanted to play. So whatever would have happened, had I have just carried on, and 10cc wouldn't have happened, but I had a career carrying on as a songwriter, I would have been in a band, some kind of band somewhere, playing down a pub or doing something, because... or just playing around at people's houses, because I love to play with other people. That's one of the great you know, joys in my life is being in a band.
And you had a solo album in 68, The Graham Gouldman Thing. Was that something you enjoyed doing?
I did, very much. And I've released a few solo albums over the years.
You have a new one. That's good.
Yeah, I've got a new one. I have notes. Yeah.
Yeah, no,
yes, I really like to do that. It's more of a kind of a vanity project, really, now. But the pleasure is in the writing and the recording. Writing, recording, and playing live, those are the three things in my work life which I feel, you know, blessed to be able to do.
I mean, it seemed like you had almost sort of one of those Brill Building, which is the New York equivalent of what you were doing in England. You know, one of these things where you were just like writing like a lot of songs for different bands, and some of them, you know, were big hits like Heart Full of Soul and For Your Love and No Milk Today, which I think is a great one. And a lot more. And then when you were in 10cc, it seems like there was a lot more sort of a collaborative songwriting going on. That a shift for you?
Yeah, no, I like that. I've always liked collaborating, and I do to this day. It tends to bring something different out of you. Like, for instance, a song like, I don't know how familiar you are with the I Have Notes album, but the track two is a song called We're Alive, which I wrote in Nashville with Beth Nielsen Chapman and Gordon Kennedy. I probably wouldn't have written that song on my own, but I was in Nashville, so it's got a kind of country vibe, and, you know, it's just one of those things. I guess I wouldn't have normally have written that.
Well, and you played.
So, in other words, different things happen in a collaboration.
Right. No, you played the song "Floating in Heaven" at your show that you wrote with Brian May.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely song, and you know, it's always like nice when, you know, someone plays the new material. I'm like, oh, and it fits so well in with the other stuff. But
yeah, well, yes, I did actually. I wrote that on my own, but Brian
made
a massive contribution to it with him playing on it and backing vocals and everything else. I'm very careful. It's nice to bring something else in, but it's got to kind of fit, you know. And I think it's also maybe a little refreshing for the audience just to get out the 10cc thing, and then we go back into it.
Right. Well, so your album And Another Thing, which I think is from 2000, I know there's a songwriting collaboration with you, Chris Stifford, and Suggs from Madness.
Yeah. There Was a Day, that song was called. Yeah. That was written at a writer's week that our publishing company at the time used to do hire this sort of big old stately home and get like 15 songwriters down there and then put three of us together every day to write and see what happens. And that was the result of that collaboration.
Well, it's just funny because it's like it's three of my favorite bands kind of randomly, not randomly, obviously, but pulled together. Like, oh yeah, of course.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah.
You, Madness, okay. And 10cc, Madness, and Squeeze. That makes total sense to me. When you all were deciding, like, okay, we're going to do this debut album, you'd recorded Donna, and that had been a hit. And you co-wrote a lot of the songs on that album, like Johnny Don't Do It and Sand in My Face and Rubber Bullets. Yeah. How did that work? Like, what was the dynamic among the band like at that point?
We were starting to remember that Kevin and Noel were already a kind of a team. So that kind of left me and Eric. Eric wasn't as experienced a songwriter as I was or Kevin and Noel. But he actually, I think he kind of learned his craft from being with us. So because Kevin and Noel were kind of a team, I was left with Eric. And that proved to be an incredibly successful collaboration. But so generally there'd be two teams, but often, as you can see, like on Rubber Bullets, it's Kevin and Lol and me. And you know, there's a few times where the four of us all write together, or it's some kind of combination. But in general, it was myself and Eric, and the other team was Kevin and Lol.
Right.
And what we'd do is we would present our songs to one another. And it wasn't like, do you think we should record this? It was always, we're going to record this. We never rejected anybody's song. We always said, if you think it's good enough to record, then we'll do it. But I have the right to make some notes.
Right.
And change a few things.
So like with Rubber Bullets, which is, you know, you, Kevin, and Lal, was that a song that they did that you added to, or did you come up with
together? Exactly. They said, we've got the chorus, and it was a brilliant chorus and a verse. We need a middle part, and like a bridge. And so I added that, and some,
so you did
some
the
lyrics.
Sergeant Paper.
And also that's got a major to minor thing in it.
Right. You also have this thing where you'll change the tempo in the middle of a song too.
So. Yeah. Well, I got that from, I started that off with For Your Love. Not that it was an original idea, but I sort of, it became a thing, another sort of trademark, if you like. So I wrote that part and some of the lyrics as well.
Nice. And then with you and Eric working together, how did that work? It sounds like it was sort of by default. Would one of you start a song, or would you actually sit in a room together? And
we'd either sit in a room together, or one of us would have a title. Because I've been talking about us, actually, famously, I've been sort of banging on about us writing a love ballad. And we'd never done it up to that point, not a real love song. We might have done sort of a sort of comedy kind of, like Donna is a love song, but it's not like a,
right,
you know, it's not like a sincere love song. And Eric came, but we resisted it because it was a kind of like a cliche, everybody does that. But actually Eric came up with the perfect title, I'm Not In Love.
Right. The great denial song of all time.
The great denial song, yes, correct.
How about something like, I mean, you talked in your show about Wall Street Shuffle, and I think you guys were walking around that area when you came up with that.
Yeah, we were driving through New York to a gig, and someone said, do the Wall Street Shuffle, I think, in the car. I can't even remember who it was, but it was like, ding. You know, it's like one of those things, someone says something, or like famously Dreadlock Holiday, the line, I don't like cricket, I love it, which is really like the signature of the song.
Right.
Somebody actually said that to me during a conversation I had it with somebody I met in Jamaica. And we were talking about sports, and I said, what about cricket? Do you like it? He said, no. I said, oh? He said, I love it. So I thought, bang. And then Eric and I were writing at my house, and we were talking about what had happened. He'd been in Barbados, I'd been in Jamaica. So we're talking about the West Indies, and I've got the guitar, man. I'm going, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. You know, you start doing something that was related to the conversation. And so, then that started it all off.
So with Wall Street Shuffle, is that, do you guys come up with the music and the lyrics together, or does one of you?
Yeah, every co-write. There might be a balance more of someone did more music, someone did more lyrics, but it's always words and music that all the writers contribute.
So, and it really is like you guys sitting together doing this, not like here, I wrote this song, you know,
no, we sit
finish it up, or, you know, cause like Lennon McCartney, you know, they started off in a room together, and later it was just like, well, we'll just put up both of our names on these songs that each of us wrote.
We actually did that right towards the end of the original band. I don't know why we even did that. It was a weird thing. But generally whoever wrote it got the credit and the royalties.
If you took just the first song from each album, like Johnny Don't Do It, Wall Street Shuffle, One Night in Paris, and that instrumental How Dare You, like you wouldn't say, oh, those are all the same bands. Yeah, I don't know if you'd say even two bands. Like it's like four different approaches.
It is. Well, it is. I mean, because we didn't have one lead singer. You know, we chopped and changed. I mean, some of the guitar stuff was different people played guitar as well. Although Eric was the main sort of lead guitarist, if you like, but he didn't play guitar. I played a lot of guitar on stuff. Our principle was whoever does the job best. So we had three number one records in the UK, which were I'm Not In Love, Rubber Bullets, and Dreadlock Holiday, with the three different singers.
Yeah, they all sound completely
on
different.
On those records. So in a one way, but this was the way we worked, and that was the end of it. It could have been a disadvantage, whereas, say, a band like Queen, Brian May's guitar is always so identifiable, as was Freddie's voice.
Absolutely. With sheet music, it's interesting that, so they're like your Godly Creme songs and your, you know, the ones you did with Eric. And then I noticed that like there, each of you has like one collaboration with the other guy. So there's like, there's a Goldman Creme song and there's a Goldman Godly song. And then there's a Stuart Creme song and there's a Stuart Godly song. Was that like that symmetry? Was that intentional?
I don't think it was. I think it just worked out that way. Nothing we did was intentional. We just did. You know, we didn't, there was nothing sort of calculated. You know, we never referred to what was going on in the charts, or we never wrote anything like in a, we might have said, it might be interesting to do like a country song or something like that, or like a jazz influence song or something, you know. But things just happened and we went, I like that, or, you know, I can, I'm not mad about that, but I think I can make it better.
Yeah, because the first album has that sort of throwback thing going on. I mean, because starting with Donna, which is a sort of a doo-wop parody, and you know, you gotta have sort of like a lot of Beach Boys-y, you know, early 60s kind of influences.
Yeah.
And then Sheet Music, boom, you're just like writing classic 70s.
Yeah. I think Sheet Music, in a way, it's my, the first, I've got a great affection for the first two albums. There was something about, I mean, a song like the Hospital song on the first 10, on the 10cc album,
right,
to me is like, it's so funny. Like, who would ever write a song like that? I can't think of anybody in the world, not even Frank Zappa, I don't think, would have done anything like that.
Yeah, that's a funny one. Was there a sense in general? I mean, you guys obviously have senses of humor. Was it always like, we're just going to make these, you know, we're going to always have humor on these records? And
no, there was no. There was no plan. This is the thing. There was no master plan. It was like, we're just going to do what we want to do. And unfortunately, other people like what we did.
Here's a song about a bomb on a plane. Okay, sure.
Correct. But is it any good? That's the thing. Yes, it's very good. It's very funny. And it's very thought-provoking at the same time.
No, Clockwork Creep is the one we're talking about for all you listeners who don't Sheet Music, which you really do. I think I have two copies of that record from the time, because I think I'd found it, a regular copy, and then I found like a, I don't know, record club version, and they have different mixes of Silly Love for some reason. One of them has these like big clompy drums on it, one of them doesn't. But anyway, Clockwork Creep, though, that was one where when you guys played that in the concert, I was like, oh, that's so cool that you're playing that. That and Old Wild Men, you know, good deep album cuts, but they're so much fun.
Yeah, when we played at the Albert Hall earlier this year, and I had Kevin Godley come on and sing Old Wild Men.
Oh, nice.
With me, which was great and very poignant, as you can imagine.
Absolutely. No, the Old Wild Men is more one of the, like, when I was a kid, that was not a song that I was like as into. And then later I listened to that album and I'm like, oh, that's like a gorgeous song. And it really came out playing live. Somewhere in Hollywood also is another one that I sort of hadn't thought about as much, but there's so many changes in that one too. There's just so much going on that record. And then
we do Somewhere in Hollywood on our, when we do our theater tours, we have a video screen and Kevin's actually singing it. He made a video of him singing it.
Wow.
And the other visual effects and things. So he's singing pre-recorded and we're playing live to him.
Well, it's one of those songs where you have a lot of these where they're just like a lot of parts to them, but they kind of all fit together in a way that you don't notice that they're like,
that's right,
seven distinct parts of the song, you know. So the structure isn't, you know, A B chorus, what, it's A B C D E F.
Correct. Well, we don't worry about A B or A B A
right
C. We don't worry about that. We go, does it work or doesn't it? So we want to do it, but I mean, one of the other songs we did with Kevin was, are you familiar with the Godly and Creme song, Cry?
Yes, of course.
Right, okay, we did that song. That, when you listen to it, is the most simplest, very simple, kind of almost in a one-dimensional, there, and it's beautiful, but there's so many odd things. When you start to learn it, are you a musician yourself?
I wouldn't with a small M. I'll just say that I can play guitar. I can play bar. You know, I could strum pretty well, but that's about it.
If you wanted to learn to play that, there's only like three chords in it, but it's the timing of sometimes there's another half bar here or there's an extra bar there for no reason. But the main thing is when you're listening to it, everything works.
Right. You
and
don't think about
really
it.
That principle of, it doesn't matter that there's a billion changes in a song or whatever it is. If it works, there's a thing of these parts hang together. For some reason, that part naturally goes into this, which is completely different. But that's part of the art of songwriting.
When you all went in to make your third album, which was the original soundtrack, again, since you don't really plan for this stuff, was there was like One Night in Paris like the first thing that came out? And did you sort of know that was going to anchor it?
I think it was. And I think originally it was Kevin and Lon wanted it to be side one of the album. But we found it was too long and we sort of edited it down. So it could have been longer.
So there's like a 20-minute version of One Night in Paris somewhere?
We never recorded it. We edited it before we recorded it, I think.
So did it have like a bunch of other sections? Like was it part five?
No, I think it was more repeat. There were no, we didn't cut any of the sections out. It was a matter of repeating sections. Or maybe there was going to be an instrumental section. To be honest with you, I can't remember exactly. But I knew it was originally going to be longer.
What did you think when they brought that song in?
I thought it was... That was awesome. amazing. Yeah, I mean, pretty much everything they ever bought. I mean, I remember the first time I heard The Dean and I. I was like, where did you get this from? You know, it's amazing.
This is only one step away. Les girls are out on bail. Très bien, there's love for sale.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the premium lager Cold Time, and the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero. Hero IPA variety packs are available so you can enjoy Anti-Hero, Infinity Hero, AZ Hero, and West Coast Hero side by side. Now you can get DDH Colada Hero, a hazy double IPA laden with a classic swizzle of coconut and pineapple notes. That album, it's like, it's the original soundtrack, but it's like scenes from a lot of different movies on that record.
Yeah, well, it was kind of a visual. We realized how visual it was, and hence the original soundtrack title.
But you're not as crazy about that one as the first two.
I think... In general, no. There's something about the first two. There's a sense of freedom, no self-awareness, just let's just fucking go for it. You know, I thought that was, I loved that. But then, you know, I've never even, if you're writing something and in that kind of creative zone, I've never been one to go, you know, like... So-and-so's doing this kind of rhythm. Maybe we should do it like that because that seems to be popular. You know, I've never done that. I've been obviously influenced by what's around me. That I think that's obvious, what my influences are as a songwriter. But I've never been sort of conscious of sort of following a trend or anything or right. Chasing a trend.
When you all came up with I'm Not in Love, did you have that sense of just that amazing, dreamy quality to it, or was that really like when you got in the studio that's how you built it?
Now what happened was we recorded it once in a kind of bossa nova rhythm, like it was almost like us trying to be like Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Mm. And it didn't work, and we erased that version, which is kind of a shame now looking back, but anything we didn't like we erased because we didn't want anybody to hear it. We came up with this idea of completely doing it with voices, nothing else. But that was the original idea. So we needed to do a rhythm track to sing to, right, to put all the voices on. And with the idea that eventually that would be taken off. But it never happened because it just everything sounded so good. And it sounded so good because if you've got a good song, it inspires good production ideas.
And and you sort of using the faders on, you know, like using the voices as like, you know, an instrument.
Yeah, we worked out a system of making these loops for each note and then putting them through the board. So the board became, the four of us actually were playing the board when we were mixing all those voices down to a stereo pair, which ended up on the track.
Yeah, what I've read was that was the song that Mercury signed you. Like they heard that and like, okay. Like when you did that song, did you think, oh, this is like our big hit single?
No, but we knew we'd done something great. No one said it was a hit. We didn't think of it in terms of it being a hit, but we did think of it in terms of being very, very special.
Nice.
Like brilliant album track.
How important was Strawberry Studios to 10cc during those years?
There would have been no 10cc without Strawberry. It was our home. So we, you know, who knows? We might have existed in another form, but have our own studio and have an engineer in the band. So a lot of the time we were just the four of us were in there. I think that created a special atmosphere.
So was that Eric sort of behind the boards most of the time?
Yeah,
then?
Eric, yes. But if Eric was singing, one of us would go behind the board and engineer it. I mean, it was just a matter of pressing record or stop.
Because you became a partner in that, what, like the late 60s or so, and then that became, yeah, even before the band started, that was sort of what got you guys together. That's when you're recording with Neil Sedaka. You were doing it there because people wanted to record at your studio.
Eric had started the studio off with a guy called Peter Tattersall, and they asked me to become a partner, which I did, like in 68 or 69, because I thought it was really important, as they did, that the north of England had a proper recording studio. Because up till then, there were kind of places with a tape recorder, pretty much, and a few mics, but we were serious.
I saw a story that Paul McCartney was recording the McGear album there. Like, I think when you were doing, was it when you were doing the Sedaka?
We were doing Sheet Music.
Oh, Sheet Music, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're kind of going in and out.
Yeah, that was cruel, have him around. I mean, I can feel his presence on the Sheet Music album.
I had Justin Hayward as a guest some time ago, and he is a single that you guys were the backing track on.
Blue Guitar. Yeah.
Was that just something where he came in and said, "Hey, I want to do a one-off single with you guys"?
Yeah. Well, he was a good friend of Eric's, and he'd written a song, and I loved playing on that. It was great. I played acoustic guitar and bass. I think we all did BVs as well.
So when you guys did How Dare You, which was the fourth of your albums together, did it feel like there were more splits in the band at that point? Like, what was happening there?
The clouds were gathering. The clouds were gathering on the horizon there. Kevin Lowell were a bit fed up with the... And Kevin and I have spoken about this a lot. They felt we were getting into a rut for me and Eric that was fantastic of, you know, writing songs, recording them and going on the road. It was great for us, but Kevin Long wanted to do other things. Also, they'd started work on the Gizmotron, which was this attachment to the guitar, which they eventually did a three album set.
Consequences
album, which would have made a great single album, I think. But anyway.
I have that album, but don't listen to it that often, I will admit.
Okay. But it's an album you own.
It's an album I found at a used record store at some point when I was so into 10cc. I'm like, oh, I have to get everything you guys have ever done.
I mean, it has got some great things on it, I have to say. Some really brilliant things. But really, that was the... and then, you know, our record company was driving us mad, like, you've got to make another album. And we said to Kevin Love, we need to get back in the studio. Can you put this project aside? And I said, no, we want to finish it. And that was the end of it.
And that was after you did How Dare You.
Yeah. And so Kevin and I have discussed this. I mean, what we should have done instead of go and finish it, we'll take the time off and then we'll reconvene. But it didn't happen that way.
Right.
But we're all clever after the event.
You know, the era that you, you know, came up in, there just weren't as many bands and not as many history, not as much history in rock. And I mean, I've seen, you know, members of the Beatles kind of talked about that later too. Like, you know, we could have, you know, like there was sort of the sense of like, yeah, they'll just sort of do their own thing for a couple, you know, a year and then come back and be the Beatles again.
And it'd be fine. I don't know. It was like a divorce, you know. You've got managers trying to make peace and everything, or trying to find a way. But who knows? Maybe even then it wouldn't have worked. We'll never know. But it's something that I regret to this day. I think we could have been, and Kevin is of the same mind, that we were talking about this actually not long ago, of how we should have sold it, which was to have let you go and do it. It'll be fine. We'll come back. We've got other things. I can do other things. It's not a problem. And maybe we should also now make it more of a cooperative, that everything we do, we doesn't matter who writes it, that we share it. Like, I know Coldplay do that.
Right.
You two do it as well. And I think everybody's happy, because you could say, well, who knows what contributes to a successful record? We know the basic things, but if you're the drummer, you know, I don't know, maybe that drum part you played is so amazing. You know, who knows that that was part of it, but you didn't write the song. This is what I'm saying, that, but you contributed to it.
Yeah. How Dare You has some great stuff on it, but it sounds like that's one where it really actually does sound like a bunch of different bands. Right.
Yeah. 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 Maybe. But I think just that I can feel the end is nigh on it.
You know,
it's funny, isn't it? It's interesting that a music and an album can actually give you a feeling that something's wrong.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, and it's funny because like I know what you're talking about, and it's hard to pinpoint because there's something
it's all good,
there's kind of this cool surface on that record that is there's a little more like Sheet Music is a much warmer record than How Dare You,
it was more fun. More fun and interesting to make. It was more exciting. And so maybe it was also because we got used to being 10cc, you know.
Right. Even though being 10cc meant so many different things. I mean, original soundtrack, like the fact that your singles are I'm Not in Love and Life is a Minestrone. Like, again, these are totally different sounding songs, both wonderful, but just like they don't sound like, I think part of it is that you guys are so creatively restless. Like the idea that you've done these four records that really don't repeat themselves. And yet it's like, oh, we're in a rut. Like you sort of look back on it. I'm like, well, I wish I'd like to be in a rut like that.
Yeah. Nice rut to be in. Yeah. I guess so. That's right. But maybe there was something, a combination of things that the Kevin Law were a bit disgruntled and we were feeling, maybe we were feeling it a bit. Well, here's another. Now we've got to be 10cc again. Whereas before we were 10cc, but now we were conscious of being 10cc.
Do you think that the commercial success just sort of amped up that pressure because the record company was paying more like, oh, well, we need another one of those now, as opposed to...
I suppose so, yeah. Yeah, they wanted us to... I mean, we'd got into a cycle of writing, recording and touring. That was what we did. And Eric and I had sort of aspired to that all our sort of musical lives. Whereas for Kevin Law came from a different place, you know, because I'd been in bands, Eric had been in bands,
right,
successful bands, but Kevin and Law hadn't.
I'd seen somewhere, and I don't remember where it was, that you guys had actually gone to start recording the fifth album and there was like disagreement over the song People in Love. Is that right?
Yes. Kevin Law hated it. And actually, I'm not mad about it myself.
It's not in your set, I noticed.
Even though I co-wrote it, yeah, no. It's sort of there's something simpering about it that I really I don't like.
But did that song actually play a factor in them leaving?
I think it was a minor element. They didn't like it, and we actually tried. I think we said, okay, you don't like it, but with going on the principle that if you don't like it, make it better. I remember we had the backing track and then we all went in separately to add backing vocals or guitar part or something to see what would happen. could it be made that we'd go in and go, wow, Kevin, those BVs you did have just transformed it into something wonderful. That didn't happen.
Right. Well, it certainly doesn't sound like what's on Consequences. So, I mean, their head was in a different space.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you guys have Good Morning Judge and Things We Do for Love at that point of the process?
No, I think we had that when we were starting. There was a bit of a gap, and then we recorded the Deceptive Benz album and started writing. We were on a mission to kind of prove ourselves. And I think we did. I love the Deceptive Benz album. You can hear that Kevin and Lolly aren't there, of course.
Right.
But I still think it's a good album.
Absolutely. No, yeah. And those
it's got
two.
I think it's got some really good stuff on it.
No,
I'm quite proud of that album and the Bloody Tourist album. And then it's downhill all the way.
It's funny, like a friend and I, who we grew up together, like when one of us would get sick, one you would say, oh, I got a cold. The other one would say, oh, is it a badass, the mother of them all?
That actual phrase was something my mum used to say to me when I come in, when I was a kid.
Really?
Came in from the cold. She'd say, take your coat off, Graham, so when you go out again, you'll feel the benefit.
Oh, nice. I thought you were saying that she said, it's a badass, the mother of them all, when you had a cold.
She never said.
I was going to be impressed by that.
Badass, as far as I remember in her life.
But, you know, yeah. And then again, you know, Good Morning Judge and Things We Do for Love are just like two just great, yeah, you know, songs that boom, you came out. Yeah. So it's like proof of concept right there.
Yeah, no, I think we were on a mission to prove that we could do it without Kevin Law, because we decided to retain the name. Our feeling was that we'd written a lot of the, like, I'm Not in Love and other songs that were hits. It just felt, and also we felt like we spent like a few years building this up, you know, what I'm not going to give it up. And it worked for a while.
And were Kevin and Lal okay with that at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I told them, you've walked away from a gold mine. I said, fine. There was no, like, oh, we need to retain 10% of the your future record royalties because we've helped build the name up. You know, it was none of that. They just walked straight out of it.
Would you listen to their albums later and think, oh, that would have been a good 10cc song?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's just you and Eric on your own. Did you still write the same way at first? Was it still just the two of you?
Yeah.
At what point did it become more kind of you guys doing it separately?
Later on, when we were not getting on, to say that Eric was difficult is an understatement. But I'm a very patient person, but even I have a breaking point. But, you know, looking back, we did very well together. I'm grateful for that musical partnership.
Was it a musical division between the two, or was it just sort of more of a personality working relationship?
Not musical.
Mm.
I'm not going to expand on that.
I'm not going to pry on it. I was just curious. No, I mean,
no, we didn't want to go in different musical directions. We were pretty, you know, we were quite on a par musically. Our influences were, our major influences were the same.
Yeah, no, I have all those. I have Look Here. I have two versions of 10 out of 10. I had the American version and then found the British version because I realized it had like three different songs on it, three or four. Yeah. And that was what got you, you know, Andrew Gold into the mix. And then you.
Best things that happened to me.
And he was actually offered a spot in 10cc. Do you think 10cc could have gone on more if he'd joined the band?
Yeah. Yes. I do. I think his contribution and his personality would have suited us very well. I loved Andrew, right? When Andrew was suggested to come in to co-produce and co-write with us, I was absolutely delighted because I was already a fan of his. And we got on right away. And so when Eric and I split, Andrew was the first person I got in touch with. And then we carried on during the 80s. You know, we had artistically, I think, a very successful relationship, productive relationship with Wax and beyond. Yeah.
And you had the Animalympics soundtrack
Earlier. That was in the early 80s. Yeah, I enjoyed doing that. That was very good.
When there were these, you know, sort of, I don't know if you should even call them reunion records, but you had Meanwhile, which
that album.
How did that even happen? Like, it's very strange because it seems like it's, Godley and Krim are back, but they're not really.
It's horrible. The whole thing was horrible. First of all, working with as great as the great Jeff Porcaro and Freddie Washington were, they weren't our drummers, you know. I mean, the whole thing, Gary Katz, it didn't work out. It was horrible, the whole era. I fucking hate that record.
Yeah, I never thought, I thought the Gary Katz was sort of a strange, like, I don't think of 10cc and Steely Dan in this. I mean, even though you guys are
A lot of people do.
I know, I don't though. It doesn't make sense.
I think the record company, thought that. But really, we should have done a test, you know, like, let's do two or three tracks, see how it works out. If it doesn't work out, because there's a chemistry involved in it. Also, in us having an outside producer. And anyway, I could do a whole other program on that album.
Were all four of you ever in the same room together during that?
Yeah. But it was a legal, a contractual obligation album for Kevin Lowell.
And then Mirror Mirror also seems like it's like your solo tracks and Eric's
Eric
solo
and
tracks.
I had it with each other. I did my bit and half and Eric did his.
So, and then that was it?
That was it. So, and then we did do a tour together, I think, in Japan in 76 or something, and it was horrible. And that was it for me. I'm out!
Was it tricky for you to be able to sort of get the name 10cc to still tour with it?
Nobody objected. Nobody. I know people weren't happy, but nobody did anything about it. And actually, for quite a while, I had Graham Gulman's 10cc or 10cc featuring Graham Gulman and friends or so. And then I thought, oh, fuck this. We've been doing it for so long. Everybody knows about it. It's the music of 10cc. It's a touring band that I will not record under the name 10cc. Get over it.
Right. Yeah, there's no 10cc album coming up. You just put out your solo
album. Absolutely not. That's only my solo albums.
If you know, the other guys gave you a ring and said, hey, you know what, let's just get the group together and do one last tour, the four of us, would that ever happen?
No.
And if they wanted it to happen, would you want it to happen?
I can't see it happening. I know Hell Freezes Over.
No, I know.
It won't happen.
In the meantime, and I did mean to ask you about this too, you produced the Ramones' Pleasant Dreams back in the 80s. How much production had you been doing at that point where they're like, oh yeah, let's have you produce a Ramones record?
Well, I'd always, you know, we'd always always produced our own records, including 10cc records. We never had an outside producer except with Gary Katz, if you can count that. But I'd produced the Animalympics album. I produced an album. I don't know whether I did Gilbert O'Sullivan. Do you know Gilbert O'Sullivan?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I did an album with him. I can't remember. I think it was after Animalympics. And I think it was after the Ramones. But anyway, but the Ramones thing was very odd, that because the first thing I said was, why me? We're like a million miles apart musically. So I think it was to do with the British invasion. They loved like the Yardbirds and the Hollies and, you know, the Kinks and things like that. And they thought there was some similarity, I guess. But I tend to say yes to things. So I said, well, let's give it a shot. If it doesn't work out, we'll just, after a couple of tracks, we'll say thank you very much and goodbye. But I went to New York, did all the backing tracks, and they seemed to be really happy. I know Johnny wasn't happy with the album, but Joe was great. He was lovely, very conscientious, seemed to like everything.
Having worked with your own band in the studio for so long, what did you think of how that band operated?
Well, they operated, I was surprised at how they were always on time. They were quite professional, really. Joey was wanted to do things. Let's do that again. I can do that. I can do it better. You know, it wasn't like, let's just go for it and that's the end of it. And that's the take. You know, he was very conscientious.
Yeah, and obviously it still sounds like a Ramones album. Like it doesn't sound like 10cc.
It doesn't sound like 10cc, but it's kind of polished. I know there was a bit of criticism, but you know, what did you expect? Sorry.
So in your production on it, were you sort of helping tweak the arrangements? Would you sort of suggest like chord changes?
I'd make a few suggestions, but there wasn't that much to do once we'd set up the, you know, the sound of everything. We weren't like changing drum kits or try the Music Man bass instead of the Fender. It might sound that it was none of that. It was pretty basic, you know, because that's what they were.
From what I understand from that period, like Johnny and Joey, there was a bit of friction there. Were you aware
with
of
the girlfriend? Yeah.
The KKK took my baby away.
Yeah, I know. I actually found out that afterwards. I wasn't really aware of it during the recording.
It didn't really spill over.
But I know that Johnny, God rest his soul, was a kind of, what can I say, slightly awkward guy. He wasn't as friendly as the other boys, but that's fine. You know, that's what his personality. He was a major part of the band. Well, they all were, and his guitar playing was, wow, really a major element of what they did. Besides Joey's voice,
and you played a little guitar on that record too, right?
A little bit, with Johnny's permission, I have to say.
Yeah,
I checked it with him, and he said, "Don't play anything I couldn't play." I said, "Okay."
They weren't like fighting in the studio or anything.
No.
And then for Record Store Day, was it last year? There was the Pleasant Dreams of the New York mix, which is this other mix of the record.
I've got it actually. I think I've got two copies. I haven't played it yet.
Yeah, I was going to ask what you thought of that, or whether were you happy with the initial mix of the record?
Yeah. I wouldn't have let it go otherwise.
Right. So tell me what's next now. Do you sort of just write songs on your own? Like, do you still just like to carry a notebook around and get ideas and, you know?
Songwriter's radar is always, the antenna is always up for ideas. But at the moment I have notes and I'm very happy with that. We're in the middle of touring. We've got rehearsals tomorrow. Then we start a new British provincial city tour that lasts for a month. Then we've got a couple of weeks off. Then we're doing a Scandinavian tour. And then after that, we're going to the Caribbean, but just me and my wife.
Oh, not with the tour.
No.
What do you get out of doing the tours now?
Oh, I just love playing. Well, you know, I just love it. The boys are great. We're very good friends. We have a lot of fun. Traveling is a bit tiring, but I just like playing. Simple as that. And it's a joy to play those songs. They're brilliant songs to play.
Yeah. And again, you've been playing with, you know, several of these guys for a long time. Rick Fenn's a marvelous guitarist, by the way.
He's a wonderful player. Extraordinary player. Sometimes he's soloing and I'm like just back there listening to him going, wow, this is great.
Yeah. No, the show had a really good spirit about it. And I was really happy to.
I think that comes across because we kind of respect and we love each other, and I think, well, you said it, you can feel that, you know, that we're all enjoying ourselves and there's a lovely camaraderie between the band. It's really important.
Kevin doesn't want to join the band?
Not permanently, but he's done the odd gig with us. As I said, he did the Albert Hall with us earlier this year. He wouldn't join up now.
Thank you so much. This is like such a pleasure. You were like, when I started this podcast 3 years ago, you were like on my initial list because I just think you've had this sort of, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, like I hate that institution, but like in my Hall of Fame, you were like, you're in there for sure. Just, I mean, the stuff that you wrote even before you joined 10cc is so great. And then 10cc is just like one of the great, just, you know, creative bands of all time. And, you know, with songs that are just kind of in my bones. So I didn't have to like, you know, re-listen to stuff because I know those records so well. So.
Okay. That's lovely. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, wonderful talking to you. And I hope I hope it won't be another 40, you know, 6 years till you get back here again.
It won't be. There's talk of us coming back next year, actually. I don't know whether that will happen, but we're talking about it.
All right. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Bye-bye. Cheers. All the best.
That's all for episode 157 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Graham Gouldman for reflecting on such a long career of creating songs that live in my bones. You can learn more about him on his Facebook page and at grahamgouldman.info, which lists a series of 10cc late November tour dates in Norway and Sweden and an Australian tour planned for next summer. He'll also be playing Heartful of Songs solo dates in England next March. Gouldman's latest album, I Have Notes, is available on vinyl, CD, and digital streaming. Carapop is produced by Chris Swake, who doesn't like reggae, he loves it. If you've gotten this far, you must like Carapop, right? Any chance you can support us? For a mere $24, you can become a Carapop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carapop.com. We appreciate you all. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carapop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at CaroPopcast. You can follow me as well, Mark Caro at MarkCaro. I'm also on Blue Sky now. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carapop conversation. Thanks.